This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
And Rebecca, we're going to start with my interview because I talked to Alan Ruck, aka Conor Roy, unfortunately not destined to be president of the United States, although maybe it's unfortunately for the Republic as a whole. It's so exciting to talk to him. I mean, everyone in Succession is great in every episode. It's kind of the magic of that show. But I feel like Conor and Alan Ruck's performance has had a really special run this season with this like surprisingly lovely wedding that we had earlier as Logan's death happened. I mean, Rebecca, am I crazy that Conor's been kind of a... Like he made you like him more than you're used to this season.
Yeah, that monologue about being a plant or a rock. I can't even remember exactly what I watched, and I was like, Alan Ruck.
Like a plant that grows on rocks.
Yeah, it was just, I think that might be my favorite scene of the season so far. It's just cool to see him to get to do so much this season, and he's one of the only ones that wasn't nominated yet, right?
Yes. So. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in our great strategy of figuring out who to talk to from a given show, with Succession, it's so hard because there's so many great roles. But this is the season for him to get his due. And so I was really excited to get to talk to him about all of that. So let's hear my conversation with Alan Ruck. Alan Ruck, thank you so much for coming to talk to me. As we're talking Succession's 8th episode has aired. Conor Roy is not going to be the president. How are you feeling in this time of great mourning for your character, Conor Roy?
You know, I think it's not a great period of mourning. I actually think he might be mourning the old man, but he's not really mourning the political thing. He's still going to weasel something out of it.
Well, Slovenia sounds like the destination as this episode ends, which he seems more excited about it than I would have expected. Maybe I'm underrating Slovenia as a destination.
Well, you know, these people are so messed up. It's just all about what can I get?
Mm-hmm.
What's my new thing I just got?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think he sort of wins this prize and he feels like he had something to do with Mencken, you know, whatever. He feels like he was a little bit of a player and he won this prize. But I think, you know, buyer's remorse will sink in, as with many things.
Did you ever think for yourself about what this campaign has looked like off camera, about what, you know, Conor's war room and campaign managers might have looked like? Does that help you at all as an actor to think of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I just think being on the road is being on the road. And as you probably know, it kind of sucks, you know, moving around so fast, you know, and keeping to a schedule, and you can get played out. So, I'm, you know, I relate to that.
Yeah.
And then I just think he would have finagled things in a way where he got to come in, make some, you know, inane speech. Shake a lot of hands, not very little conversation, and then out.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Do you think those speeches sounded as wild as that concession speech that we actually saw? Like, not much reality to it.
I can't imagine there would have been much different.
Well, Mark Mylod, who's directed a lot of these episodes, says that you're very good at kind of running in character, like with what they call it freebies, where you kind of improvise for a little bit. And I wonder if any of that happened, and if there's versions of the concession speech that you get to run with on your own a little.
I don't recall doing it with that, because I mean, it was just a solid, I mean, it was just golden, and I don't know what I would have added to that thing, because he's just so small in that moment. You know, I think I probably would have tried to make it a little more heroic, you know, a little more positive, but he's just a dick. I'm sorry. He's just terrible.
Well, he's had a good season, though. And the trick of this season, I think, before this episode had been that we felt sympathetic toward Connor in a way that I don't think we ever have before. Like these really lovely scenes with Willa, like I think their relationship had all this nuance to it, to where I was really rooting for them by even in this, like, you know, trading their souls to endorse Mencken. And I know that, like, playing kind of the idiot son has, you know, can have its wear and tear on you. Like, you want to be able to show more of him. So even though he's a terrible person, is there some joy for you in getting to reveal his humanity a bit more this season?
Oh, I had a wonderful time. I had a wonderful time on the show from the beginning. They gave me a lot more to do this year, and that's always fun.
You know,
that's always the best, you know, best way to work, just stay busy. I've had a wonderful time, you know, because they give you these little clues, because it's not just like a decal. It's not just pasted on. All these characters have like weird depths and, you know, idiosyncrasies and stuff. The writers are really good about that. They give you these little clues and then you just use your imagination and it takes you wherever you go.
Yeah. I mean, the wedding episode, when you get the reveal of the loony cake, which is like sort of a revelation and sort of opens this whole other door that you don't get a lot of answers for. And I think that's the way the show works. You're not always going to get every single piece of the backstory. But it felt like a lot clicked into place for that character when I saw that detail. And I wonder if it felt that way to you, too.
Yeah. I mean, he's alluded to things before in the second season. I can't remember what we were talking about. And I can't remember where we were.
Where in the world?
No, I think we were in Scotland. I think we're in Scotland. And I had some little speech about Roman starts to give me some shit, and they're chasing me out of the room so they can do their little schemes together. And he says something snarky. He's like, "Oh, my mommy was in a crazy house," you know. And
what a horrible thing to say.
I mean, it's just one of a million little pieces of nasty shit that we're so good at. You know, they didn't give me a lot of opportunities to snap back, you know, and like argue. He just never did. He just kind of absorbed whatever they're throwing.
Yeah.
So here and there, like he said something like, you never had it as bad as I had, or something like that, as hard as me, something. And so then you find these things out. Mommy was, you know, had psycho-emotional challenges.
Yeah.
She had a pill problem. She had a liquor problem. She was in and out of institutions, you know. And then if he wasn't with her at home, if she was away, then he was at a boarding school somewhere. So I think it was pretty lonely.
Yeah, really sad.
Yeah, not great. Dickensian.
Well, you get the retort in the karaoke scene of the needy love sponges response, and which is heartbreaking, but also a pretty good line. Like, I feel like Connor really ends that scene on top somehow, despite being heartbreaking.
He's not entirely unaware of himself and his place and the dynamics and the other people. I mean, he's lived with them for years. He knows exactly what they are, really. But he keeps going back. Like, he has that big dramatic speech, the karaoke. And then, of course, the next day is just horrific. But he keeps floating back to them because he doesn't have any other. He has Willa, which is, without Willa, Connor's story is just darkness.
I know. Like, at the end of that episode when she's in bed, I couldn't believe how relieved I felt for a character who, again, should not be president and is a bad person. But, like, I wanted her to be there so badly.
Yeah.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You guys only finished filming this a few months ago, right? Like, production went pretty close to when the season began.
I think I was finished in the middle of, it might have been February. Yeah, I was in the middle of February, but I think they went until March.
Okay, so but still just a few months ago. I mean, I wonder what that come down process is. You know, you said in another interview, like, you've been known that you get to go back to this great job every couple months. You know, you take a break, and now that that's gone, like, have you kind of wrapped your head around that change in your life?
just recently, I had this crazy dream that I was watching Succession, and I wanted to call up a bunch of people to tell them how good it was. But everybody, this is dark. Everybody I called was dead.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, no. You know, so that was some big,
something psychological. Subconscious,
it's over. You know,
did you wake up thinking like, okay, well, the show might be over, but at least not everyone's dead. Like, it's not as bad
thank
as
God.
Your subconscious made it out to be.
Yeah.
I mean, your career, I think, trained you to jump from thing to thing to thing and kind of adjust with change in that way. So is it kind of like regaining those old skills that you had of, you know, changing jobs that frequently?
I remember the job I had before Succession. I mean, I've done a couple in between things, but the series I had before was The Exorcist with Gina Davis on Fox. And I had gone back to Chicago where I had started. I felt like Rip Van Winkle because like everything looked the same, but all my friends were really old. You know? And I started to dig the town again, and I just enjoyed that experience. And then I got this job, and I went right from Chicago. I never came home to LA. I went right from Chicago to New York for wardrobe fittings or something. And I didn't know anybody, and I was like, I just had the best experience of my life. And you people are never going to measure up. and then they all proved me wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like over and over again, it was one of the nicest groups I've ever worked with. Great crew. Everybody brought their A game. You know, everybody was just adding extra, like, love to this thing. So
yeah,
really made it fly.
Is that kind of the joy of an actor's career? Is that, you know, you move from thing to thing. Sometimes you'll go into something where it's a terrible working environment, but that there could always be something even better around the bend. Is that kind of what keeps the engine of a career going, that knowing that could happen?
I think that most actors are actually missing a chip. And it's like that let's face reality chip, you know, because we don't want to spend that much time. We want to make our own reality, right?
Yeah.
I think you just always keep thinking. I mean, I have some friends that are really talented, and they never really got national recognition or anything like that, you know, but they did their work in, you know, different areas, Chicago, wherever, and are really terrific. And I hope it's been satisfying for them.
To have a career even without national recognition.
Yeah. Just to have enjoyed all those productions. And
do you feel like that would have been like, you can imagine that path for you, like if you had had a career where because it's sort of the same thing, right? You get to escape into a different world.
Yeah. Yeah, but what did you ask? Do I think things could have gone the other way for me?
Yeah, like, or if you imagine yourself being happy with it going that way, like if you had like a solid regional theater career, like would that have worked just as well for you?
I think at this point in my life, I would have made peace with that, and I would have been like, "This is really cool, and I belong here."
Yeah. You know? Well, because I think you've talked about Ferris Bueller and being identified with a single role in that way as being a real double-edged sword, and I think you kind of got that burst of recognition, and then having to grapple with it in a different way, that, you know, fame and success comes in a lot of different ways, but that's a really distinct way to kind of wrap your head around all of the different things that recognition can bring. Like, it taught you a lot at that age.
Yeah. It's fleeting. Mostly. It's like, oh, look at this guy. What's next? You know?
Well, and like people see you as a character. I mean, this happens with Conor Roy too, I assume. And like, you're kind of like a walking character as opposed to being an individual person. And I imagine it feels different this time being identified with a distinctive character as when you were in your 20s. But it's sort of the same thing, right? Where you merge with this fictional creation.
Yeah. I mean, that was a terrific part. And I worked really hard on that. And this was a terrific part. And the writing was so good. I mean, McFadden said this once. He said, it feels like all you need to do is put on the clothes and walk onto the set.
Hmm.
You know, because the writing is so good. And in a way, that was true. It was just an amazing confidence we had with each other, everybody's chops. You knew everybody was just going to nail it. And then we just had great love and faith in the writing.
Yeah.
We just felt like, oh, just propelled into doing.
How do you look for what's next when you move on from something like that? Does it change what you want? I mean, I know you kind of go where the jobs are, but does it change what you look for and what makes you feel like something's right for you?
My criteria now are really sort of small and shallow. I want to work on the West Coast of North America. If I could work in Los Angeles, that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anywhere up to Vancouver, same time zone, all good.
Yeah.
That's mostly it.
Well, it's a practical thing, right? Having like a working acting career.
Yeah, because Mireille and I have these kids and they're getting to the point where they don't want to travel around the world anymore.
Yeah.
They have their lives. And so being able to stick close to home.
Yeah. I talked to Dagmara Demenchik a couple weeks ago and she has teenage kids and is living in New Jersey. Yeah. And it's like her and her husband figuring out how to work in New York. Like, you know, I have little kids and I have one consistent job, which is hard enough. Like the idea of having to jump around a different job. I don't really understand how people do it. She actually, the way she talked about working on Succession, I think she did more of this than you did, because I don't think Connor like sinks into the background of a scene. But learning to be in a scene where there's eight people and you don't know who the camera's going to be on or when it's going to be on you or what's going to get used, and learning how to react and to be present in something. And I wonder how that worked for you, if that was a learning experience for you, if it felt more like theater that you've done in the past. Was that a different way of working on Succession?
I really enjoyed it. At first, you're like on high alert. You're like, oh. But then what you just do is you just stay in it.
Yeah.
You stay in it. And if you don't talk for 10 minutes, you know, you just listen. You mm-hmm. just try to soak up what everybody's putting out, you know. It just keeps you in the tone of the room. And if you do that, if you really listen, if you really keyed into what the transactions are between people and you clock that, you will always be in the right place. You will never not be right.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you get surprised? Because I know you watch the episodes kind of live when they air. Do you get surprised when you see what makes it in?
Yeah. I mean, the great thing about like Mark Mylod and all our directors is they just shot the hell out of everything, mm-hmm. you know? And so a lot of those freebies that Mylod would call, sometimes there was some really zany stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but just maybe wasn't appropriate, but, you know, just didn't actually fit what was going on in the scene. But we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun doing that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really nice way to work because the script is so solid. And then you shoot it like that a few times. And then they come up with all these alternative lines, mm-hmm. especially for someone like Kieran.
Yeah.
Roman. They had like pages and pages of like just nasty shit for him to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he can make up his own now, which is good.
Oh, and God, that's a double-edged sword, too. I don't know if I want that skill.
Well, I think he can just put it in his hip pocket and save it for later. But and then we would do these, you know, freebies, just like whatever came out of your mouth. And sometimes you just paraphrasing, but sometimes somebody does something squirrely and
yeah,
it's good.
I was watching, you were on The Daily Show talking to Al Franken, who of course has extensive actual real world political experience. Like, do you find yourself talking to people who have like been in these halls of power, who like want to talk to you more, or what, like expect you to know about the ins and outs of the real News Corp? Like, has it given you a different status in those worlds?
I haven't had any of that yet, besides Al, really, because I just haven't met too many politicians lately.
Do you want to?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've liked a couple of them in my day.
Well, it kind of makes me think about the broader question. Like, are you eager to leave all this like halls of power stuff behind? And like, you know, in terms of the work that you do, or in terms of what you're thinking about, like presumably you've thought more about the actual Murdochs than you would have if you weren't on Succession. Are you ready to kind of close that chapter?
Learn about the world.
Yeah. That's how,
you know, so that's the way we actually grow.
Yeah.
So
are you kind of eager to like close that book and read the next one and kind of figure out what's the next part of the world you'll learn?
Yeah, I'm happy to do something new.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Jesse was right to end the show now. I think by the end of this season, we will have told that story of Succession.
Yeah.
And what came before, I don't know, maybe that's interesting, but I think what comes after is just quite dreary for basically all the people involved, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think life gets better.
Well, like, and I don't want you to spoil what's coming next, but like, I think the tone of episode 8, where you end with this like shock and horror of what they have done in electing this guy, like it makes me feel like it is setting up into a much bleaker world, because Succession can be so funny and I think you can enjoy watching them so much. And I think that was a really sharp reminder of like, no, they're ruining America and you need to remember that.
Yeah. I mean, I think different people will come away with different things. There's people that just actually can't watch our show because there's no heroic person. There's no person to root for.
Yeah.
They're all just despicable. That never, ever bothered me. I'm happy to hear about creeps, you know. But, yeah, I mean, people will react to the next two episodes. However they do, some people will be like, well, that wasn't so bad. You know, other people think it's – no, I'm serious. Yeah. And other people think it's, you know, the end times.
So how do you watch the episodes? You watch them live on Sunday nights. Like, what do you with your family? Do you watch them on your own? Do you have a plan for the finale when it's all truly over?
No big party plans. I usually watch them with Mireille, my wife. We've been tag teaming because her show Lucky Hank on AMC was on the exact same time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
On Sunday night.
That's insane.
Yeah, so we would, you know, we would take turns.
That's not fair at all. Someone should have done something about that.
Above my pay grade. I don't know who to talk to.
And the kids aren't old enough to watch Succession yet, it sounds
no,
like.
No, Mireille keeps saying that to our 12-year-old. Someday I'm going to do something that you can watch.
Does she have any interest in it? Like, do your kids care about what you do?
Yo, yeah. My little girl, she's not little anymore. She's 12. She's quite taken with Video Village. Oh. So she's gone to visit Mireille on a few sets, and she's sat next to the director.
Oh, so she's like a future filmmaker.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
She likes to write, so we'll see. And then my littlest one, Larkin, is 8, and he can, like, cry on cue. I mean, he can really work it.
Wow.
So I think we're in trouble, you know, because he's, yeah. I mean, he just throws, like, his whole body into, like, whatever grief he has because you said no.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So either a future actor or just a manipulator.
Maybe. Or a lawyer. Lawyer.
Do you have any feelings about your kids being actors, being the children of actors?
I don't mind at all. I don't mind. You know, I have grown kids by my first marriage, yeah. And my eldest daughter has a beautiful singing voice and is very funny. And she got an agent in New York, and she tried it for about 4 years and hated every minute of it. Just you sing your heart out, and they're just like, thanks, that was great. That's it.
Yeah.
You know? And so she went through that about 100 times, and then she said, this is bullshit. And she went back to school, and now she's a nurse.
Huh. Wow. Yeah. Well, because like that, you know, your career broadly, like you work so much and you've kind of worked on so many different shows and you come in for a little while and you don't know if you're going to come back and you have dealt with that uncertainty and I assume a lot of auditions that you didn't get. And do you think that you were kind of born ready for that? Is that something you learn over time? Does it make you a stronger person when you get through that many kind of ups and downs and changes in your career?
I have a really good friend named Jim Fife, who was my understudy in Biloxi Blues in New York back in the 80s. And he's one of the funniest people I've ever met. He did stand up for a while, and then he became the headmaster of a private school.
Wow. So,
right? But he had kind of a checkered relationship with acting, and he said, acting to me is like a beautiful girl, and you meet her one night, and she actually takes you to bed, and you think you're in love, and then she doesn't return your calls.
Mm-hmm.
And just about when you're ready to get over her, like a year later, she calls up and says, why don't you come over?
And you keep coming back. And
well, you know, you're like, maybe it'll be different. It's that thing. Tomorrow will be different.
Do you think that at the age that you are now, there's like you can weather it more? Like if she calls back, if she doesn't, it's kind of you feel more even about it than you did maybe when you were 30?
It depends what it is. I mean, I think there's things you can still get really invested in at any age. And you're like, oh, my God, I want to do that. I want to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't think that really ever goes away.
Yeah.
I wonder about people like Gene Hackman, he's been retired for like 15 years now or something, right? He's 92
yeah.
or whatever it is. And I know he writes books, but I just wonder if he's just totally done with it.
So you feel like there's no retirement ever for you? Like you'll.
I don't think for me, you know.
I mean, acting when you're 92 sounds pretty good. You get to work with good people again.
Short days, hopefully.
Well, I also have this thought about Conor Roy being a billionaire running for president. Like that's the most insanely hard job. Like if I were a billionaire, like that's the last thing in this world I would want to do. Like work fewer hours and do less.
Well, you know, the one thing, he's not mean enough.
Mm-hmm.
Conor doesn't have teeth.
Yeah.
Not many. not like his brothers and his sister and many other people in the show. So he would really be a shitty president. I mean, besides the fact that he's not equipped on any level, just the fact that he doesn't have an edge that way. Mm-hmm. That's like, I'm the boss and shut up or I'll kill you. You know, I don't think he really possesses that.
Yeah, I don't think I'd make a very good president. It sounds like you also don't have the sharp teeth for be the real president.
No. I'd have my head in my hands a lot. You know?
So, Rebecca, now speaking of people doing standout work on television, because that is this time of year, you talked to Steven Yeun, who is the star and an executive producer on Beef, which is just this like big hit on Netflix, despite being incredibly dark, which maybe is a trend on Netflix, the place that brought us Squid Game. And it's such an incredible performance from him, who's, you know, he has shown a lot of his talent in his movie roles before, but there's something really special about Beef. And I'm wondering if you cracked the code of what made his character so like pathetic, but intriguing all along.
I think it's because, you know, he and Ali Wong signed on before there were even scripts. So they really got to be much more involved with the creation of the storytelling for Beef. And there's this scene at a Korean church where his character Danny breaks down. Mm. And, you know, Steven talks about how he was raised in the Korean church and he knows what that feels like. And I think it's that level of authenticity and the way he relates to this character in some ways that really makes this performance just like so incredible.
Did you get any insight on how a season 2 of Beef will be possible? I think we all want to know.
Yeah, you'll have to listen, and I definitely ask about. I mainly wanted to see what he kind of thought happened to Danny after this season, but he does talk about how he had always sort of thought that this was going to be a limited series, and they intentionally made this story have a beginning and an end. So he seemed fine with it, maybe not, you know, going on and this being the end of Danny's story.
Well, I have mixed feelings about it because the show is so great, but it also ends so well. So maybe he's on the same page that I am of how do you top something as good as the first season of Beef?
Yeah.
Well, let's hear all of that and more in your conversation with Steven Yeun.
Today, I'm so excited to welcome Steven Yeun to the podcast. He's the star and EP of Netflix's Beef, which premiered in April to much acclaim. It's been one of my favorite series of the year by far. So I'm really grateful that you're doing this interview with us. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Rebecca.
I talked to the show's creator, Lee Sung-jin, before the show aired, and he told me that the two of you have been friends for a bit and were talking, and I'm curious how he sort of brought up the idea of this series to you.
Around that time, we were frequently having conversations here and there, just about anything and everything, and they would go long and end up in weird places, a lot about existential angst at the time. And so when he called me, I was in New York. He called me one night and he was just like, hey, I have some ideas that I'm like throwing around. Do you like any of these? And he said, Road Rage. And instantly I was like, Road Rage. There's something about Road Rage. And when we got into it, it was, you know, the Spider-Man meme of a Spider-Man pointing at another Spider-Man. Just kind of the climate that we're still in that we were deeply embedded in at that time. And then we ended up at God in that conversation at the end. Mm. So whatever that is. And it kind of just became this natural process. And we spoke for about a year. And then when we went out to start pitching, Ali jumped in and then it became more realized and it's more special. And yeah, we find ourselves here now. So it's kind of wild.
Yeah. Ali Wong and you have such an incredible chemistry in these roles because two characters really have to play off each other for the series to work. Did you two know each other or did you sort of have to develop that kind of relationship for this?
We knew each other, I guess, just being Asian Americans in the business. You know, I remember I was on Walking Dead when her first special came out and I remember watching it in my trailer being so blown away. I immediately DM'd her on Twitter. I was like, you're so great. Thank you for holding it down. And yeah. And then we just kind of briefly met here and there. We worked on Tuca and Birdie together, but we never really got to see each other consistently. And so when we were building up to do this show, I don't know, it just kind of felt right from the very get. And we didn't have to do a lot of chemistry things. If anything, we just had to remind each other, not explicitly, but like through kind of hanging out on set, that we actually like each other. So that when we got on set and had to say the words that were written, we could just go there because we felt safe. So it was really nice.
And Sunny had told me that the character that was going to be opposite Danny was originally sort of thought of as like a Stanley Tucci kind of character before Allie came on. I'm curious, for you, how did it being Allie sort of change how you approached Danny?
Well, I think it made Danny a little bit more flawed. For me personally, it made Danny more judgeable. It became more difficult in a way to reason with someone like Danny that would just go at it with Allie like that. You know, when I think it's like someone that's like you're punching up, it's very clear, you know, you feel justified. But with Allie, there's so many aspects, especially between men and women, like there's so many aspects that feel like you could be punching up, you could be punching down, you could be misunderstanding each other. There's so many complex things at work that everybody just kind of becomes more gnarly. And so I think what Allie brought was a real deep, truthful complication to the whole thing that I think, were it not for her involvement in this, maybe the story would have been a little oversimplistic.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that. And since you and Allie, you know, were a part of this project from the very beginning before scripts, tell me a little bit about developing the character of Danny. What did you find sort of most difficult about when you had to sort of get to understand him and I assume not hate him, you know, to play him?
Yeah. I think what's hard, and this reflects a lot of my larger process as an actor, is you're usually trying to deduce who someone outside of yourself is, which usually leaves them in a lot of judgment. You've kind of made an archetype or an understanding of who you think this person is. You've said, oh, this is this guy. He's broken. He's fucked up. He's kind of shitty. He does reprehensible things. He's not evolved. Or you can make all these assessments about this person. And then you have to say, oh, I'm going to play that guy. And I think the difficulty was that, like facing the inherent shame of someone like that.
Right.
And in turn, then having to face your own shame about whether you can really empathize with someone like this and really understand their position. And that was tough at first, but, and it continues to be tough. I think that's a difficulty of shame. We love in this society, I think, to just kind of leave people defined in negative ways and then leave them there. And so for me, I felt like we were playing with aspects of ourselves, not explicitly like Allie and I individually, but more like as human beings, who are we and what are we on a daily basis? Are we just like a performance every day, or are we being honest and truthful about like who we, how we feel and how we feel wronged or how we feel unsupported by society or reality? So it was that. I mean, sorry to get so heady about it, but like that was what building Danny was like, exploring all the shame of someone maybe not looking their best.
Well, the other people who've worked on the show that I've talked to about you all say you are kind of heady and cerebral and you like to think and talk it out. So I'm, yeah. I don't think you have to apologize.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's just known. I'm sorry, y'all.
I like it. I that's why you're on the podcast.
Thanks.
Was this character at all inspired by people in your real life, or do you take inspiration from things you observe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of it was a lot of the Venn diagram that Sunny and I share of our experience growing up. We're both non-coastal Korean Americans that kind of grew up in the Korean church. And so there was a lot of archetypes to mine. There was a lot of stories. There was a lot of cousins to make fun of as we were building these things. But then there's also that half of you that, you know, you look at your old friends or your family that you've kind of left in judgment. And there's also that feeling of like tender, warm love that you have for them too, in their broken humanity. And so, yeah, we were just kind of mining from all aspects of people we know, parts of ourselves. It feels like a question like this, and even this exercise of making a show like this, is really just, to me, it makes me think about what does it mean to be a human being.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Speaking of being raised in the Korean church, that scene where Danny breaks down in the church, I think I've seen lots of people posting on social media and saying, like, this is such a specific experience and I've never seen this captured before. And it's so relatable for a lot of people who have sort of grown up in that church. And I'm curious, for you filming that, what that experience was like for you.
It was all the feelings, you know. I relate to that experience. I also am aware of the way in which that particular experience is judged, in the same way, and I'm part of that too. I judge that experience as well, positively or negatively. And I think the exercise, again, was we really wanted to express the Korean church not as a place to be kind of sold or like proselytized or even a place that's condemned. We were just like, this is where people gather and this is what human beings do here and look at what we are. And I think that was always the approach of that scene. And so, you know, for me, that scene was really, it helped me understand a lot of things. I remember after high school, I stopped going to church often because I was just kind of off doing my own college thing and I didn't really find the time to do that. But whenever I would go back, I would find myself really tearing up during praise moments that were happening. And I always, my whole life, I was always curious. I'm like, why am I about to cry? Like, what is this? Is this, I feel safe again being here because, you know, this is the one time in my childhood where I felt safe? Or is it because I'm in a Korean church? Like, I think certainly all those things contribute, but while we were filming it, this thing really appeared to me, for me to understand, which was we shot all the band, we shot the extras, and who were phenomenal. The background actors were incredible. There were also people from the Korean church too that resonated with that experience. So it was very authentic. And I remember I was supposed to cry, and I remember coming in, watching them do this praise song, and I was like, ooh, I feel it. I think it's gonna be a good scene. I think we're gonna get it. And they turn the cameras on to me, which then asks everybody else to be quiet because we need it for sound. And so everybody isolated me, and I tried to get there and I couldn't. And I think a long time ago, a younger me would have panicked and just tried to like squeeze it out and like just blast through it and like come up with something. But I realized that something was wrong, so I asked for a break. I asked if they could shoot some other things, and I was like, give me like 10, 15 minutes. Let me just like walk around and think about this. And then I came back, and I realized that it's because everybody stopped singing. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, like it was because I had been isolated. And the inherent purpose of praise or group experience or singing, whether it be praise music or a live concert, secular concert, is that you can lose yourself, that you can, you know, you don't have to hang on to your identity so hard, your personal story. And Danny's personal story is bleak, the one he tells himself. And I think in being able to let that go for a second, there's got to be such a deep catharsis to that. And that's what it felt like. And so when I asked the background actors, like, could you all sing? Can we just continue to sing? And they did. Then it was just like, boom, like it went straight there. And that was cool to learn for me.
That's so interesting. Yeah. It totally makes sense. I see what you're saying about needing to hear the song. And so their story ends at such an interesting place. But did you and Sunny and Allie talk about what happens to them after this show? I know he's talked about a 3-arc series in his head, but for you and Danny, how much did you think about where he goes after this story ends?
We haven't talked about it too extensively. It was always just kind of like up in the air. I think from the very get, the way we pitched this was as an anthology, a limited series. And so we did want to close that loop at the end. Certainly there's more that Danny could go through. I honestly don't have any specific understanding of like where it could really go. I think there's a lot of places it could go that it almost feels impossible to narrow it down to one. But yeah, we talked about it. We joked about it. But also when you revisit it, you watch it again and you're like, yeah, it's pretty complete. You know,
I know they went through so much in one season.
Yeah. And you know, on a human level, like the journey doesn't stop there because you've come to some understanding. It is a continual practice to be alive, but you know, maybe this is an origin story. Who knows?
Yeah. And I'm curious. You know, the series has so much comedy in it that mostly comes from sort of a dark place. But how did you sort of find that balance on set to make sure it still fit with the tone of the show?
Yeah. I mean, I think because the tone was as grounded as we were going for, while having moments that were totally just like insane at times, I really had to lean into never bailing on Danny. You know, I knew that the performance needed to stay within the boundaries of an acceptance and an understanding of him as opposed to a judgment of him. And there are many moments where I just wanted to judge him, where I was like, you want me to do what today, Sonny? Like, what am I shooting? What's he doing? And it was all about not leaving him high and dry, because I think that would have compromised the whole character, to be quite honest. I think Danny, to me, is a character, and Amy as well, is a character to be related to kind of reflect off of all of us. And if I would have bailed on any part of him and left him in shame, I think that would have opened the door for all of us to bail on Danny. And so when I found myself in situations where like I knew the joke was on him, I was like, okay, the joke's on Danny, and I'll be the guy patting him on the back while he looks so pathetic.
And I know you and Allie and Sunny released a statement about David Cho after sort of hearing people react to him being included in the series. What was that process like for you?
Well, I think, you know, personally for me, I don't really care to go too much into that aspect of the show. You know, the show is, to me, like talking about the show is most important. But I think for us, we didn't want to leave people in mystery. We wanted to say what we wanted to say. And, you know, the statement for us was pretty complete for us.
Yeah. I do want to sort of look at your overall, the work you've done lately. I think you have the most incredible taste. Like, I look at your films, like Sorry to Bother You, Okja, Burning, Minari, Nope. Like, it's just an incredible run that you've had.
Thank you.
I'm curious, what is your secret to saying yes to a script?
I don't have any secrets. For me, it really becomes about, I can get into the weeds about how lucky I am, for which I am incredibly fortunate that I find myself being in positions where scripts that I didn't know existed, or stories that I didn't know existed, or directors that I didn't know knew me, kind of approach me and they're available. So I have to lead with, I have a lot of luck. But for me, the thing that I always kind of gravitate towards is, are they trying to say something? You know, is the story trying to say something? And I don't even mean like, is it trying to teach something? I don't really care to teach anything. It's just, is it trying to reflect something off of our society or off of something that I believe? And I think every script thus far that I've said yes to had something that deeply resonated with me in every aspect. It never became like, I need to do this type of role. It was more like, oh, you're saying that? That's pretty cool. And you as a filmmaker are bold about it, even cooler. Like, I'm totally down. You know, for me, the best directors are the ones that are the unequivocal leaders of a set. And I know that's the role, but you can kind of suss it out when you meet someone like Boots, when you can meet someone like Bong, Lee Chang-dong, Jordan, Isaac, there's these leaders, and it doesn't feel like they're hesitating about their decisions. Especially all of the people that I mentioned are like extremely prepared, but then their magic comes when they let go and they just see what unfolds, and they always leave space for that. And that's, to me, like a really exciting mark of a great kind of director, auteur, writer. Because they're writing something that they're curious about, that they're trying to express, but then they kind of like let it go and they go, this is out of my hands. This is now in the hands of an actor or a cinematographer or an editor. And it kind of goes through these stages. And yeah, that's kind of who I'm looking for. I'm looking to work with great directors.
And you've wrapped your work on Bong's next movie, right? That one's...
Yeah.
All done. That's exciting. Yeah. You guys are reuniting. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, he's I continue to be amazed by how gracious and wonderful he is.
I'm curious, you know, The Walking Dead was such a moment for your career, which is now quite a while ago, but do you feel like that was such a major turning point when you talk about kinds of roles that would come towards you or that people would reach out to you about after that? Or do you feel like that's more of a more recent development?
Honestly, I think for me it was Director Bong. Mm-hmm. He really took a chance on me with Kay, and I feel so grateful to him because he saw me when a lot of people didn't see me, even myself, really. And he took a chance and really pushed for me to be in that film. And after that, I've kind of just been riding a ride of, I think that was a challenge for me to tell my personal point of view. And then furthermore, actually right after Bong was Boots, and he hadn't even seen Okja. So again, Boots as well. I think there were people that maybe were open to me, but I had to also have space and openness for them by saying maybe no to a couple of the things that came right after Walking Dead, which weren't like, let's be honest here, like it wasn't like 10, 15, 20 things. It was like maybe like an idea that we could develop here. Do you want to play like a tech CIA agent on the run? And I was like, no, I don't. And if anything, The Walking Dead afforded me the ultimate privilege in feeling financially secure, amongst many other things. But I'm very grateful to that experience for sure.
Yeah, that takes away that pressure to say yes to whatever for a job at that point. Yeah,
yeah.
I hear you. Well, Stephen, I really appreciate you talking to me a little bit. And for everyone listening, if you haven't checked out the show yet, I don't know what you're doing. You better tune into Beef. It's on Netflix now. And thank you again, Stephen.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider. Read everything else we do at vanityfair.com. And find us on Twitter on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From PRX.